Well, good evening. I have some here's something extra on top of the extra. I see. South Mountain China Tours. Ooh, this is such a wonderful thing. Andy Ferguson is leading tours in China. Oh, I got two of them. I got it on my email also. You can go to Bodhidharma's cave, sit zazen in Bodhidharma's cave. They're reopening Bodhidharma's burial temple. So I will leave these out for you all to see. It's pretty cheap, actually. I've forgotten how much it is, but it's not even very expensive. I have some pictures. This is Poreg, and this is Felsentor. So if you all want to see these afterwards, they're there. And I was taken to the theater the other night, to Theater Works, and it turned out to be a really good play, and it has lots of Zen in it. It's called Ambition Facing West, and it's about emigration, how somebody in Croatia came to Wyoming with an Italian wife and had a child, and that child grew up and went to Japan with her child. And so it's very contemporary, very beautifully staged, and the mother and the son at first is I went with a teenager with their daughter, and she called him a rocker dude. And he was this real energetic kind of guy who who couldn't sit still for a minute until he got involved with a temple, a Zen temple, and learned to sit zazen. And suddenly he got really interested in it. And then she's this sharp businesswoman, you know, no nonsense at all. And she just thinks he's gone off the deep end. And so there's a lot of very wonderful dialogue, very quick. And it has depth because it shows the past at the same time that the present is happening. So the past is interwoven with the present in many different ways. So you can sometimes get to Usher if you don't want to buy a ticket. So you can see the plays for free if you show people where their seats are. And then one more thing is this. This is Sakyadita, which is an organization of women all over the world whose aim is to support and further women's position in Buddhism. In many countries, especially in the Far East, women don't count for practically anything. And it's claimed that women have no, can't be fully ordained because they lost the ability to do that hundreds and hundreds of years ago. You have to have so many ordained women in order to ordain somebody. And so and there's a great article in there noticing that the men, when they first started this, didn't have so many men to ordain. They just did it. They just said, okay, you know, we're ordained. Now let's go ahead and ordain some more people. So it's... there's some touching articles in there, too. There just was a meeting in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, and people came from all over the world, not just nuns and priests, but lay people, lots of lay people, too, including two people from San Francisco Zen Center who were asked to chant the Heart Sutra in Sino-Japanese. And so they wore their robes, and they stood up on the stage in front of everybody, and they chanted, Kanji, Zai, Bo, Zatsu, Gyojin. And afterwards, people said, are you Japanese? And they said, well, no, but you're wearing Japanese clothes. Well, yes, but, you know, and so they tried to explain. But unfortunately, no Japanese women came to that meeting. So they represented the whole Japanese Sangha from the San Francisco Zen Center. So, lots of show and tell tonight. And tonight we're starting the Riding the Ox.
I've got some extras in case some people weren't here last week.
Good.
You were three handouts, yeah?
I got them, yes.
I would like a set for Nancy,
yes.
If you have some.
Sure, sure. I got mine, so I'll... There it is.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's interesting to have the Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and the Daido Luri to compare. They're practically the same, but there are little differences. Daido has done something with the whole idea of it and turned it into a little bit more about actual practice rather than about a kind of fairy story of enlightenment. It's still kind of a fairy story about enlightenment, but it's it has a quality about practice in it that's very helpful. And Daido says in his introduction, to please not let it get, I've forgotten the word he used, to make us feel discouraged. Sometimes when you position things in the way that there's this ultimate place and way to be, and that we're not there now, and so we have to work real hard and get there, then it becomes sometimes a very discouraging kind of idea that can be a hindrance to our practice.
I remember feeling that way when I first read Paul Ripps.
Yes.
Coming back and reading the other translation, it was much more, I don't want to say enjoyable, but it was more practical or realistic.
It's, yes. He actually, they have these paintings in, at what is it called, Great Mountain?
Zen Mountain
Monastery.
Where is it?
It's in New York, Mount Tremper, New York. I almost went there last year. There was a teacher's meeting there, and it just didn't work in my schedule. But it's a huge monastery, and Daido Luri established it. He practiced with Maizumi Roshi in Los Angeles. So he's one of the many white plum teachers, they call themselves. There are many of Maizumis, and many of them have temples in various places, and that's one of them. And it's very organized. I have one of his books where he talks about the training at that temple. And when you go in there to train, you follow a path that's very carefully laid out, year by year by year by year. And he says these paintings were given to them, and that they were there when they established the temple, so that this is a kind of model for them in a way. They are, Maizumi Roshi was Rinzai and Soto, and he ordained people and transmitted them in both lineages, either lineage, or sometimes both. And Daido, I think, is only in the Rinzai lineage. I'm not sure about that, but he certainly emphasizes it. And he does have that. I think that's his transmission as Rinzai. And Rinzai is a lot more about enlightenment than Soto. In Soto, it's hardly talked about. And in Rinzai, it's the goal. So that already gives this a flavor that is new for us in a way. And it can, that also can be an impediment as well as a help, depending on what kind of ideas we have about enlightenment and our practice and our, I don't know, worthiness to practice. When I first started to practice, I didn't think I was worthy to practice. It took me a long time just to go into the Zendo, because I thought that was for, you know, real Zen people who were way ahead of me. And it took me a long time to feel any kind of confidence in my own ability to practice. And some of it, I think, had to do with the idea of perfection and purity and enlightenment, all those that those sort of ideals that are projected it's hard for some of us to find our own seat and have the confidence to begin to really look at what's going on. Because, as he says in his book, and it's an interesting book. It's hard to find. But if you can find this, or some of you can share it, or this is Donna Lynn's book. I'm supposed to get it from Amazon, but they haven't sent it yet. He has a chapter on each one of these pictures, and they're helpful. But don't let it discourage you. I guess that's what I'm basically saying, is let it be an inspiration. The way that training is done in Japan, he says in here, and I know it's true in archery, because Koban took archery from what do they call them? A treasure, a national treasure, an archery master whose family has been teaching it for 500 years in Japan and making the bows and arrows. He's now teaching at Naropa. He's been at Naropa for the last 20 years, as well as Japan. Kanjuro Shibata is his name. My oldest son lived with him for a while in Kyoto. The way he trained Koban was to have him sweep up and clean the place. He wouldn't let him shoot the bow and arrow. He got to watch. Sometimes he got to watch, but most of the time he was just the cleanup guy. And he was very strict with him. And only after a year was he allowed to actually come out and observe, closely observe what was going on. And only after another year was he allowed to hold the bow and the arrow and get some sense of what it was. So it's one of those, and he gave no explanation at all, the teacher. He just let the whole thing soak in to his students. There's a great book about that called Zen and the Art of Archery that describes a German man who went and endured that whole training. And when you are allowed to shoot, you shoot from a very close distance because these little bows don't go very far. And you shoot at a bale of hay with a great big target, so it's real hard to miss. But the whole idea is not to hit the target so much as to let it shoot, to release your whole agenda and drop your sense of self and be completely spontaneous and just shoot. Phew. And the German in that book describes how long it took before he finally dropped his self-consciousness enough to really just shoot the bow, shoot the arrow from the bow. In a way, we all have some kind of aspiration or we wouldn't be here. We call it way-seeking mind. And we don't really know what the way is that we're seeking. But there's a sense that there is a way. And in a way that we are the way. The Quakers have a saying, proceed as way opens. And I think that's a very Soto Zen kind of way of talking about this, that there isn't a path that's going off and we just have to find it winding around the mountain, but that we are the path and it opens up day by day and hour by hour and breath by breath. So that when we're awake to our life, we're constantly surprised. We really don't know what's going to happen next. So you could say maybe that this first ox herding picture is about realizing that that we're not stuck. One of the great sufferings of human being is that we often get to a place where we feel really stuck. And we don't know who we are or where we're going. And there's a kind of relief to know that this is the place. And then we go as we can, modestly and humbly. I talked about patience at Jikoji on Sunday, and the three aspects are forbearance, endurance, and acceptance. So, you know, with those qualities, we can put up with a lot and do a lot. Especially in terms of our practice. If we can manage to stay with meditation, to stay with our determination to face what this is, to really be with what this is, be with the whole field of us as it shifts and changes. And to begin to really study what it is. Dogen says, study the self. Study the self. So this one is, Dido says, vigorously cutting a path through the brambles. It feels like that in Zazen sometimes. Sometimes it can be pretty brambly. Making space for all of it. And of course, being being a Rinzai practicer, Daido also points us to great faith, great determination, and great doubt. Those are sort of the rallying cry of the Rinzai practicers. Great faith, great determination, and great doubt. Not the niggling doubts, but the big ones. What is this really? Who is this really? Where are we? Sin, flesh, and bones is much more conventional, but it's also interesting to see. And they're fairly much alike, so you'll see. They're not too different. What Daido did also is to use where he is, that northern New York world. They own, I don't know, hundreds of acres up there and a huge lake. It's supposed to be very, very beautiful wild country. And so he used that world as the images in here. And it makes it a bit more real. The maple leaves and the cicadas and the oriole singing, they're all images from where they're actually living up there. So, are there questions? Well, there's in one of these, there's a story about bulls. That, there's an old Zen story about many bulls. There's another one about many geese. They just used it as an image. In the old days, it was a very valuable animal. It still is in India. You know, oxen are extremely valuable and precious.
It could be the, what it was the symbol of or the metaphor of something very precious.
Well, yes. And also very powerful. Very powerful and originally wild. So, you know, it, as a metaphor for, you know, training oneself, it's certainly, you know, your wild character. Sometimes they call it a monkey, you know, or monkey mind bopping around. And it, you can feel that too, but so it does feel sometimes like a big old lumbering animal that has a mind of its own and just goes where it wants to go, whatever I think I want it to do. So, Jane?
The thing that comes to mind for me, I was wondering that too, why an ox? And I just finished reading a book about the 49ers coming across Death Valley, the, a particular party that got lost in. They took a shortcut that was ill-advised, and they got stranded with no water and no food, and they had herds of oxen that they brought with them to colonize California once they got here. And so they ended up having to eat their oxen because that's all the food they had left, and the oxen shrank and shrank and shrank so that they were went from these powerful animals down to just skin and bones, and they were able to finish the animal in a day, which was ridiculous because it should have lasted them months. So anyway, these animals endured real hardship with them, and the horses didn't have the strength that the oxen did. And at one point, they turned the oxen into beasts of burden, and they're not meant to be that. They're meant to pull carts. And one ox in particular, carried the children of this particular family. And if it weren't for this ox, the kids wouldn't have made it. They couldn't walk any longer. So years later, the man who wrote this book was traveling through California, and he recognized that ox who had carried the children out of Death Valley. And the person who had acquired this ox, it changed hands, and this person knew the story of this ox who had carried the children out of the desert. And so this ox was not put to work. It got
yeah.
Like in the 1890s, when you really, I wouldn't think that somebody would be. Well, I guess what this story told me is the loyalty of this oxen, and that this very practical pioneer man would have been moved and recognized that quality in that animal. So I guess what I learned from the story, and why I'm bringing it up now, is that I think there's a relationship that we've forgotten, that I think our society's forgotten about our relationship with animals, that they serve us, and that in many ways we serve them also, and that there is this this bond, and that there are qualities of a living creature that I guess that we share.
Yeah.
And it's not the big divide that we're kind of used to feeling these days with animals.
Yes. You know, Vanya does an animal rescue thing. He's very much into that animal, no eating of animals or using animals in any way, and is part of a big organization, one of the many organizations about that. And he has an ox story about an ox that had been taken into the slaughterhouse to be slaughtered, and it didn't want to do it, and it jumped through a window. A window that was up high and about this big. And this big ox just whammed right through the window and ran away. And they all ran after it, and they couldn't catch it. And it was in all the newspapers. They couldn't catch this animal. And they finally, when they caught it, Vanya asked for it. He said, "Please, may I have this ox?" And then they boxed it up and put it on this tram. I can't even imagine. It's this little tram. I think I have a picture of it. They must have taken some seats out, but in that little tram, they put this big ox in a box. And took it up to a meadow and a barn about halfway up the mountain. And he pointed out the barn as we went by in the tram. He said, "That's where the ox lives, right up in there." It was amazing. He just refused to be caught. And then people couldn't believe that Vanya would want it. You know, he would buy it so they wouldn't kill it. Yes, I bet they do. I bet they do. But what you're saying is right, I'm sure. And I'm sure that that's why an animal shows up in here. Because, of course, we're animals. It's not only that we're connected to animals in every kind of way, but we are animals ourselves. And our animal nature is not only recalcitrant and scary, but a great and powerful and wonderful force of us. And unless we really understand it, it's difficult. It makes our life more difficult.
I think there's something too for me about the inversion of the order of things, that perhaps this is a Judeo-Christian thing, having dominion over the animals and the world.
Mm.
But that seems to be an example of our how we put the mind and our discriminating abilities in charge. And that's been a real problem for us. And so to me, that it's an animal who apparently is to be mastered and tamed here, that's what it looks like, and that's how we take it. But I don't think that's really how it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you notice in the end the animal disappears.
From D.T. Suzuki has the circle as the last item.
Yes.
This one has him riding back
into yes.
town on it, which is
yes.
a very Soto message. It's the Bodhisattva message.
It's the Bodhisattva message.
So it was funny, I was talking to somebody about D.T. Suzuki and what he did for us in the West, and the person said that, you know, he was very biased. He was a Rinzai guy, he was an academic, he wasn't very serious practitioner, but he tried.
Mm.
And I said, I basically didn't agree. I thought that he did a good job of informing us. And in that sense, the fact that the two sets of pictures don't align.
Mm-hmm.
Only adds to the reminder that it's not fixed.
Yes.
And there's some interpretation. There's your, like you said, it's your path and your path and your path.
Yes.
Everybody's route is a little different. And we may come back to one. We may stay on one forever. We may not see that you can, stage-wise, you can't get to the next one. So we live it.
Or we may revert to, I think, looking at this, we have to realize that some days we're in that empty circle and some days we're right back at the beginning wondering, you know, where am I? What am I doing? And starting over. That it isn't just a progression that gets us to some exalted state. It doesn't work like that. Samuel?
Which came first, the poems or the artwork, sort of, or does it matter?
From what I've read, it looks like the artwork came first. But it looks like they're together actually, because they're the same. They're virtually the same, aren't they? I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. It's so old, I'm not sure they know very much about it. This little essay that Donna Lynn found has a little bit about it.
Well, it's pretty vague about.
But it's very vague.
But they don't know.
No, I don't think they know.
Because you wonder what inspires what.
Mm-hmm.
That's what mm-hmm. My thought that which one inspired which.
What would you think?
Well, to me it's art first, but then they're both art.
Yes.
When it's so deep and true and just comes out, it's both art. So I guess it doesn't matter.
Well, you know, often in Japan and China, artists were both painters and poets.
Mm-hmm.
and they often painted a painting and wrote the poem right on top of the painting. So I don't know. This shows some calligraphy, which must be the poems, without pictures. And it doesn't really explain what they are. Prose texts and commentaries on the picture, on the 10 oxherding parable. 1300s. So I really don't know.
And it's not important. It's just, you know, against the music. It's like what came first, the words, like in Bach's
yes.
Mass.
Yes.
The setting to this or the music, but it's just so amazing how sometimes it's they're together. I remember hearing, I don't remember what it's called, by Wynton Marsalis, a world premiere. He did it in San Francisco. It's called All Rise.
Hmm.
And I wasn't paying attention to the word. I was just listening to the music, and all of a sudden, all the orchestra went, bah, bah, and I swore I heard All Rise,
huh.
But it was many movements, and it was like by the second hour, you forgot what it was called. And then you heard the huge choir say yeah. All Rise, but before you even heard uh-huh. the word, you heard the music. It's like almost the instrument spoke it. It reminded me of the story in the Bible, and I don't remember, it was so long ago, I haven't read the Bible in years. It said that the animal spoke, actually, it spoke to one of the prophets
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't listening to God. So the animal actually spoke to him, and the guy was like, what? Did the animal actually speak? And it reminded me of that. It's like the instruments were speaking.
Yeah.
That's pretty, it's...
That's so fabulous.
What's that?
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But the animal did speak. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, people that believe in the Bible believe that
yeah.
the animal spoke.
Yes.
Or what is it, the bush of fire?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Moses or
mm-hmm.
somebody? One of those guys.
Good name.
In a sense, they often use pictures and words as like teaching stories versus talking about it. And in China, it started as Nihonga, came to Japan and became Zenga. And G-A means painting, and Zen is what the paintings are of.
Mm.
So it's very common, like Angie said, that your voice, that you would have it complementing each other. Sometimes you might have one word, you know, in a flash of a brush, or a picture of a landscape with, you know, a couple phrases. So my understanding, just briefly reading, is that this was a teaching parable to talk about what Zen was in the 14th, 13th century.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I think, when it was coming from China into Japan, and that was how this, I think, theorized how it came from this, right?
Yeah. Well, it's really addressing the big question of the self, which is one way of talking about this big question of, you know, what this is. I was just reading a little psychology today in a book about psychology and Buddhism. And I don't know much about psychology, but apparently there was an English psychologist named Winnicott who had an idea about the self that was very interesting. He said, the mother and the baby are one being. The baby just thinks, it doesn't even think. The baby is just the mother, completely attached, completely dependent on the mother. And then at a certain point, there's a break. And then the baby has to have some kind of object. So the object becomes himself, herself, her. So instead of the mother being it, then it's oneself is it. And then he said that in maturity, people, if they're wise and able, actually make a break with that self notion. And their next object is the self with a capital S. So that the self and the self become one. It's very...
Versus separate.
Huh?
Versus being separate.
Instead of being separate, yes. And the small self is actually dropped so that, you know, ultimately it's just spontaneous living, or living with the self dropped off that Dogen talks about. And I don't think he knew Dogen. I think this is a whole completely different way of talking about what Dogen was talking about. Oh, it's after 8.
Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.